Okay, this is Greg Pallas signing off for KBOO, pleasantly and happily reporting for KBOO. And you know, stay on the next few minutes, because if you're not getting through because the lines are jammed, do it now. Hang on. Try again and get that book and the film, and I'll send you the private link for download version of it, too.
Okay, thanks, Greg.
You did fine.
You're welcome. Bye.
KBOO would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who have donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Bird and Bear, located 2801 Southeast Holgate Boulevard in Portland, and serving fresh comfort food in a comfortable setting. Lunch was provided by Little River Cafe, located 315 Southwest Montgomery Street in Portland. Sandwiches, hamburgers, and salads are made with locally sourced ingredients at this chic, artsy cafe. Dinner was provided by Fire on the Mountain, brewery and catering, with three locations in Portland. Go to portlandwings.com. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 right now.
Hi, I'm Eileen with the Oregon Cultural Trust. As a KBOO donor, I know my gift supports access to great programming for everyone in Portland. Access to cultural programming is why KBOO receives grants from the Oregon Cultural Trust, and you can help. When you make a gift to KBOO, make a matching gift to the Oregon Cultural Trust by December 31st. Then you can use the cultural tax credit next year to reduce your state tax bill. It's true. And it's how KBOO supporters guarantee access to cultural programming in Portland and all around the state. Visit culturaltrust.org today to learn more before December 31st.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. No, it's 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and here's what we have coming up for you this morning. Coming right up, it's Intersections Radio. Two women of color navigating motherhood who have written highly acclaimed books, Shanti Sekaran with Lucky Boy and Celeste Ng with Little Fires Everywhere. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, Sojourner Truth brings you sound from the People's Summit with Dr. Jane Sanders, Katrina Vandenhoevel, Naomi Klein, and Danny Glover. And remember that KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved down here. You can go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member during our pledge drive. It would be great. We would appreciate that. And we're going to go right now to Intersections Radio.
You're listening to Intersections Radio, the podcast where we geek out on all things intersectionality. I'm your host, Sarika Mehta. Welcome, and thanks for tuning in. Today, my guest is Shanti Sekaran, author of the novel Lucky Boy, about adoption, immigration, and motherhood in Berkeley, California. Two mothers' paths cross unexpectedly due to their love for this boy, Ignacio, the lucky boy. One mother is documented and one is not. And the immigration system has a heart-wrenching impact on the lives of both families. This outstanding story follows their lives as they each parent this child and fight for him to the end. Shanti was born and raised in California, and she is a creative writing teacher at California College of the Arts. Lucky Boy is her second novel. We're here at Portland's Wordstock Literary Festival. This is Intersections Radio. Shanti Sekaran, welcome to Intersections Radio.
Hello, thanks for having me here.
Let's talk about the two mothers in the story, Soli and Kavya. Tell us about them.
Okay, so Soli is a young woman from Mexico, from the Oaxaca region of Mexico. And when we meet her, she's planning to come to California, and she doesn't have papers. So we as readers end up following her across the border. She ends up in Berkeley. I won't give away anything about her journey, but she ends up in Berkeley, California. And she finds out shortly after that she's pregnant. And so we also meet Kavya. Kavya is Indian American. She grew up in America. She went to Berkeley. She's married to this guy named Rishi. And Kavya and Rishi are sort of your classic Berkeley couple. you know, they go to the farmer's market a lot. They get head massages. They drink kombucha, that sort of thing. Yeah, and they have a pretty beautiful life, but they can't have a kid, and that's their central struggle. So the two storylines end up converging around the fate of Soli's baby.
Exactly, and this is such an intense tale because these are two women of color who are mothers to the same child, and the way they fight for him to the end. From what I understand, the inspiration for the story was the news headline on a woman named Encarnacion Bail Romero, a Guatemalan woman whose child was adopted away from her. So tell us a little bit about that story and how this inspired yours.
Yeah, so Encarnacion Bail is a Guatemalan woman, and she was put into a detention center after a factory raid. She was in the Midwest, I believe in Missouri, and when she was in detention, her young son, I think he was about 6 months old to a year, around there, was taken from her and first put with relatives, but then through a series of sort of private arrangements, ended up with this American couple who decided they were going to adopt him. And so when I heard about her through the news, she was trying to get her child back. She was fighting for custody.
In this kind of case, you know, it's like there's no bad guy. There's no clear bad guy, and there's no clear good guy, because everyone is fighting really hard, and it kind of makes us think what we would do for our own children in this circumstance.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to understand. So this book is not just based on Encarnacion's story. It's based on a lot of research. There are a lot of families going through similar situations. But when I heard about this woman in particular, I wanted to understand, for one thing, what was happening on the other side of that equation, what the adoptive parents were thinking, what they were telling themselves, because it felt very natural to me that if you're the biological mother of a child and you're willing and able, then you get to keep the child. So I wanted to really understand, you know, what both sides were feeling in this.
Absolutely. I was reading this as, you know, we're both mothers, mm-hmm. and I'm reading this as a new mother, and my son is close to the age of Ignacio in the story. Yeah. How was it for you as a woman of color who is a mother to write these two sides where it is painful at points and it is joy? I mean, to write something that can reach us in such an impactful way. What was it like to that process?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, as a woman of color, I chose my protagonists to be two women of color. I didn't make that choice consciously as like a political, this is what I'm going to do, that I'm going to be representative in this way. I really knew that Soli was going to be Latina. That's just how she spoke to me. That's how she came to me. And Kavya, I just made Kavya Indian because I make most of my characters Indian, unless there is a clear reason to make them not Indian. So it was just sort of my natural impulse to create two women of color. But it ended up being, I think, an important theme of the book because it sort of illustrates how people interact now in California, what the face of California looks like now. You know, it's not black and white. It's not a binary anymore. It has been much more diverse for a long time than we've given it credit for. So I chose these two women, and writing their stories, you know, it's kind of a dance when you're a writer. It's kind of a dance between feeling very deeply for them, but also stepping back and being very technical and surgical and asking yourself, am I telling this the right way? Am I using the right words? Is this going to affect the reader in the right way?
Actually, that brings up one of my other questions. Writing a character who's Indian American, it's not like we can just paint a broad brush and we can do that just because we happen to be Indian American, but it might come easier. When you're writing a character like Soli, who comes from Oaxaca mm-hmm. and has this pretty treacherous journey throughout the book, I mean, you have to do it carefully for one thing, I know that. Where I'm coming from is just seeing other writers who are white trying to write from the perspective of characters of color. Yeah. And how that doesn't always work out properly, or how it, you know, there's a misrepresentation. So how did you feel about writing the character of Soli?
Yeah, so writing Soli was a pretty daunting undertaking. I was writing about someone who was Mexican, which I'm not, and undocumented, which I'm not. So like you said, I knew I had to do it really carefully. I started with some research, and you know, one thing that I had to do for myself was accept my limitations. I was going to have to accept that there are things that I could never know about Soli's experience. There were limitations on me because I'm not Latina. So I would have to just do my best, really. And so I think it was a combination of doing tons and tons of research into people like Soli and what their experiences were, what their personal, like reading their personal testimonies and learning about policy, and then finding the point at which I personally can connect to Soli. And that was through motherhood. That was through, you know, knowledge of what it is to be a young woman, to be in love, to want to make something great of your life, to have that impulse that drives you forward. So that's what I did.
Tell us more about the research, because there was the story of Encarnacion, which you talked about earlier, but then, like you said, what you did to research into writing the character of Soli, but not just Soli, like Kavya and everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I started out, you know, learning, first of all, how people get across the border, what that journey looks like, what the dangers are, what the methods of transport are. I learned a lot about immigration policy. I spoke to every immigration lawyer or policy person who would talk to me, really. I found some great reports about families in detention and specifically how parents lose their children through the detention process. And on the other side of it, I had to research adoption and foster care and the technicalities of that, but also the emotions of it. You know, a lot of people spoke to me about their own experiences and fertility struggles. I know, unfortunately, plenty of people who've been through those. And so I was really just trying to plug in emotionally to what I was learning factually.
All of those issues come up in this story, all of those intense issues. When you were doing this research, were there any stories that came up that were just unforgettable or still stick in your mind?
There are stories from sort of Kavya's side of the equation. There are stories of foster parents who took in children, fell in love with them, and had to give them back, or thought that they were going to adopt a child, and then found out that they couldn't have that child. And I learned a lot about the precautions that you take as a foster parent when you know you're taking in a child that is not biologically yours, and you try to put up these emotional blockades, but you're dealing with a child, you know, and it's so hard to maintain a distance when you're caring for them every day.
That made me think of, I mean, the whole point of fostering a child is for them to have stability and love and care. And how do you do that when you have to put up these emotional blocks?
Right.
How do you do that with emotional blocks, knowing that this may or may not become a forever situation?
Right. And it reminds me a little of the kinder transport in World War II, you know, the transport of young Jewish children out of the countries that were in danger to places like the UK. And I sort of learned about that just out of personal interest. And I remember learning about families who were, according to the children that were sent there, who were just like very distant. Like sometimes parents would just be like, okay, like we're going to feed you and keep you safe. And that's, you know, there was very little emotional connection. And I remember at first being very judgmental about that. You know, how can a parent do that? But now I sort of respect that distance that people force on themselves. I don't know if I could do it myself, but I understand that there has to be often a sort of safety net for parents as well.
Yeah, wow. I don't know why I didn't think about that before. Even reading the book, well, it brings up another one of my questions. The issue of adoption and adopting outside of your race. And typically that is discussed from the lens of white parents adopting outside of their race.
Yeah.
We never talk about people of color adopting outside of their race. I mean, it is pretty rare when that comes up. And in this situation, we have Indian American parents mm-hmm. who are adopting a little Latino boy.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that dynamic.
Yeah. So, you know, Kavya I wrote this whole history of Kavya that didn't end up in the book, but she was very much an activist in college. She was very into like solidarity with other people of color. So it came naturally to her to love and want to take care of this little boy who is Latino. And the only sort of obstacle that she comes up against within her own family is from her mother, who has a problem with adoption in the first place. Mm-hmm. You know, she comes from a very traditional mindset that says, you know, our children come from us. They come biologically from us. We know what's in their genes. We know their family history. So that was her mother's problem with adoption. It wasn't the fact that Ignacio was Latino. Mm-hmm. So I kind of just like put these two together, and I tried not to think too much about the race element of having an Indian American adopting a Latino. Part of that was just that I didn't know, you know, it doesn't happen very much.
Right.
So it's just, as far as I know, it's in my book. It probably happens out in the world. And it played out how it played out for my characters.
And we're here at KBOO. My name is Liz, and I'm here with Jenna. Say good morning,
good
Jenna.
Good morning.
And we're here to tell you what's happening out in this world, in our world, in the world of KBOO, is that we are having a very brief, very intense winter membership, post-Thanksgiving membership drive, and you can become a member right now by calling 877-500-5266. Or if you're not near a phone but near a computer or some other device that can connect you to the internet, you can find us at kboo.fm and become a member that way. And the reason that we are here is because we don't exist without your support. It's really just that simple. We are your community radio station, and the word community is the really operative word here. Community happens when all of us come together, and we need you to come together right now. Collectively, individually, you driving to work, pull over, make a safe phone call while you're not driving, or maybe riding your bike once you get to work, or having your cup of coffee, or just waking up. Wherever you are this morning, now's the time to pick up the phone, 877-500-5266. Isn't that right, Jenna?
Yeah. You know, one thing I really am enjoying about this program that's happening right now and this interview that's happening is so much of how this just represents to me like what KBOO programming is that you're going to hear interviews with people who are telling stories that you're not going to be hearing everywhere else. You know, it's about bringing these voices that make you really think of like, oh wow, these experiences that I might not have ever thought of, or just the complexity of everyday life being presented in a way that just makes you think, that makes you say, oh, this is humanity, this is what's important. I love hearing, you know, the story of what is it motherhood and in being a person of color and to have like adoption. I know my own family, like I'm a person of color, and what that's been to have these kind of intercultural and fairly really complicated like family stuff. And I'm really glad to hear that it's in a book, because these are sorts of things that we like to explore, you like to explore, you like to listen to these types of stories because they expand your worldview, and that's why you listen to KBOO. So become a member, because you're like, hey, I like that. Yeah, 877-500-5266, or go online to kboo.fm, and you know, consider coming in at say $5 a month. That's our lowest level there. It's really easy, just that $60 a year, and we got a couple thank you gifts that go along with what you're listening to right now. You can get that book that they're talking about, on the book Lucky Boy, and we also have the book Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng, and that's just for $60 membership at $5 a month. That's our thank you for you becoming a member at 877-500-5266.
We should mention that we have only one copy of Little Fires Everywhere. So if you're really interested in that book, you need to call right now. 877-500-5266. We have several copies of Lucky Boy, but they're going to go fast. I just know it. 877-500-5266. Show your support for KBOO's amazing public affairs programming. And thanks for listening.
It doesn't happen much, at least in our community because of exactly what you said, mm-hmm. you know, with Kavya's mother. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty accurate representation of how people think about family, yeah. that it's like as close as we can get to our genetic makeup. You know, it's the community, it's the caste, it's the region, it's, and any degree outside of that is, well, brings up some drama. So if we're talking about adoption, it's like, I've heard people, you know, just talking about it like, this isn't their real child, that kind of language, unfortunately. I'm hoping it's changing.
You know, I think in most communities, but I know in the South Asian community, a lot of progress happens through seeing other people doing right. certain things and seeing that it's okay, seeing that it's accepted by the community. I think it started that way with my experience of interracial marriage, where, you know, the first kids of my generation to marry outside of the race, it was really sort of a big deal. And the parents had a kind of a problem with it. But then by the time it came around to my brothers, by the time it came around to me, you know, we had seen other families do this, friends of ours, and it was accepted and it was fine and it was great. And so it's that sort of community acceptance that I think leads to progress. We sort of look to each other to see what's yeah. okay.
So this story, I think it's in the genre of literary fiction. From what I have heard, the ending of the story changed a few times, and it's almost a different genre from the rest of the book. And I'm curious, what are your thoughts on this, and what was the process to coming to the ending without telling the ending?
Okay. Yeah, so the ending, it tends to move faster than the rest of the book. Yeah. You know, the first part of the book was a lot of character building and it just moves slowly. And the ending, I wanted it to be suspenseful, and it did change. It sort of like did a 180 reverse. It did a full reverse, basically, with the ending from one draft to another. And I had realized that my old ending was not delivering the punch that the book needed. You know, there had been a lot of buildup, and then it kind of just like went quiet at the end. And so the new ending, I think, packs a lot more drama. It's a little nuts. I felt a little crazy writing it. But I think it works.
It is a little, wow.
Yeah. It makes sense to me for my characters. Yeah. You know, it makes sense within the context of who my characters are and what they've been through. And that was the most important thing. And I think it delivers on what has been promised in the book.
How did you feel? Well, if the ending changed a few times, how did you feel about, the characters come to life? There are winners and losers, so to speak. And how did you feel about that? Because we get so attached to all the characters. And like I said, there are no bad guys and there are no good guys. Everybody is flawed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how did you feel about how this plays out for who ends up, so to speak, in a very simplistic manner, becoming the winner and who becomes the loser?
Right. Well, I knew from the beginning that I'd have to choose. You know, I couldn't make one of those Hollywood endings where everyone's happy.
Right.
So I knew that this would be the situation. And the way that it plays out, you know, the people who sort of didn't get what they wanted, I still think about them. It's like there are these, it's like that character is a friend who had to go through something really hard, and I still think about that character. So it stayed with me. When I was writing it, I was very cold and technical and like, this is what's happening, and, you know, I made it happen. But now that I reflect back on it, I feel it like a reader might.
I mean, especially you've invested a lot of time. How long did this book take to write, publish?
From the conception of the idea to the final edits with my publishing house, it took about 6 years.
You've invested time and, you know, a lot of emotional energies. But at the same time, even if the ending had gone in a different direction, that means that somebody else is so either way, we are heartbroken and also at the same time relieved.
I've had people write to me and basically they're mad at me for what I did, you know, to various people at the end, but I had to do something to someone. So I'm like, well, sorry. I mean, it would have been the other way, and maybe that would have made you happy, but I did what I thought was right.
And it kind of speaks to a bigger issue. You know, this is a work of fiction, mm-hmm. but it is based on all of this research of real life events. Mm-hmm. So if we're feeling this way about fictional characters, what does that say about people who are going through these experiences in real life? I don't know if this is a spoiler, but Soli ends up in detention. And that is a completely horrifying section of the book as well, that experience.
Yeah, you know, I think that readers, they look to fiction to understand things that are happening in the real world. And it's not that far from what's happening in the real world. I mean, there are elements, especially towards the end, where we really get into fiction world. Yeah. You know, things happen that's what fiction is for that extra sort of dynamite that you get to put into a story. But we have always culturally related to real issues through fiction, through television, through film, you know, so this is a continuation of that.
I think what you did is not easy, writing the perspective of somebody that you don't have any experience with. That's not easy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's taken for granted a lot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about that we didn't bring up?
I just went to Mexico to promote it. Oh, wow. I just got back two days ago. Well, I just got back a couple days ago, and yeah, I went to the Oaxaca Book Fair, and this book takes place in Oaxaca, and I had spent 2 weeks in that region researching the book, so it meant a lot to me to go back. And my position in Mexico right now is that my Spanish edition has just come out. No one really knows who I am. You know, this was my chance to sort of wave to the audience and be like, this is who I am, this is my book, this is what it's about. So it was a very introductory trip. But I found that the Mexican media, I did a lot of interviews, and they asked completely different questions from the American media, of course, because they're looking at it from the Mexican perspective, and we talked a lot about motherhood and what, you know, what this means for immigration, what my book means for immigration as a whole. So it was a great experience going there and sort of bringing my book home in a way.
Wow.
I didn't realize you had a Mexico component of your tour. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Do you want to read a part of your book, if you have a favorite part or on something we've talked about?
I'll read a few paragraphs that I don't normally get to read. This is from just the moments after Ignacio is born, the few days after he's born. And a lot of this actually came from my own journals after my own son, my first son, was born. You know, it's such a new experience when you have your first child. It kind of like blows your mind. And I found myself writing down just every detail and coming up with all these like details that I was noticing about being a mother and having a child. So here we go. He was smallest at night, when shadows lapped at his edges. In the dark, he was magically small, a miracle, a sprite. It was easy in the hours before dawn to think Ignacio might die, only because it seemed impossible that such a creature could live a whole week, and then two, then three and four. It was impossible to think that 4 weeks could grow into a lifetime. Love wasn't a word that meant anything to Soli, not when she looked at her boy. Love was a television word. Soli held her sleeping son, his fists balled and eyes shut tight, clinging to a dream. What she felt for him was epiphany. She had awakened, sprouted a new layer of skin, pink and raw and wholly vulnerable. For the first time since arriving in America, she was well and truly scared. And so she named him Ignacio, for the patron of retreats. At times, the fear consumed her. Fear that Ignacio would stop, simply stop, that each breath, the revelation that it was, could surely not lead to another.
That was my guest, Shanti Sekaran, author of the novel Lucky Boy. Shanti Sekaran, thank you so much for joining me on Intersections Radio.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was such a pleasure.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio. We are on day two of our holiday drive. Give us a call, 877-500-5266. You're listening to Intersections Radio. We have a goal of $360 for this hour, so it's a great time to become a member. If you become a member today, don't forget that you'll also be entered into our daily drawing. And today's drawing is for four pairs of VIP tickets to Portland Center Stage at the Armory. Liz, how you doing?
I'm great. I'm just thinking about that $360 goal. If we had six members become members or renew their membership or give a gift membership, that would make our goal right there. Mm-hmm. And if you become a member at the $60 level, how convenient, you can pick up a copy of Lucky Boy that we were just listening to the interview with the novelist Shanti Sekaran. And it's a really interesting book about adoption and about cross-racial adoption, but not the usual story of white person adopting a child of color, but of an Indian woman adopting a Latino child and what that means in her life. It's a really important thing. And these are stories like Jenna mentioned before that you don't hear anywhere else. So now's the time. Pick up the phone right now, 877-500-5266. Once again, we have a drawing. Also, if you become a member today, you'll be signed up to win a drawing for four pairs of VIP tickets to the Portland Center Stage at the Armory. Let's get back to Intersections Radio.
You're listening to Intersections Radio, the podcast where we geek out on all things intersectionality. I'm your host, Sarika Mehta. Welcome and thanks for tuning in. The last time I spoke with Celeste Ng was for her debut novel, Everything I Never Told You, which won critical acclaim and in fact was featured in one of the first episodes of Intersections Radio. And last month she published her second novel, Little Fires Everywhere, and I suspect it will surpass the accolades of the first one. Little Fires Everywhere tells the story of two families in Shaker Heights, a suburb outside of Cleveland, and these two families are unexpectedly connected. And this unexpected connection brings the families together and eventually tears the community apart when morals are tested and mothers find and lose children and Shaker Heights and all of its rules and order are undone in the process. Celeste Ng joins me in studio today. This is Intersections Radio. Celeste Ng, welcome back to Intersections Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this book was kind of a jaw dropper in some ways, and obviously a page turner. Let's back up and talk a little bit about you and Shaker Heights, where you grew up, actually. So Shaker Heights is the backdrop of the story. Talk about your life growing up there.
So Shaker Heights is a suburb on the east side of Cleveland, and I moved there just before I turned 10, and I lived there until I went off to college and came back for summer vacations and things like that. And it was a great place to grow up. I loved growing up there. It's known for being very racially integrated, which is one of the reasons my parents moved there, for being very progressive and for being very idyllic. And it actually is all three of those things. But it's also a very rule-oriented society. There used to be a lot of rules about what colors you could paint your house so that the houses on the street would not clash with each other.
Okay, but let's say, I mean, that's the rules of Shaker Heights and not like a housing association rule.
No,
that's what's bizarre.
It's the city, yeah, and it's not true anymore. Now you can do what you like.
But oh, okay.
They're very concerned with sort of appearance and with keeping the neighborhood looking sort of idyllic, as I said. Shaker Heights is actually one of the first planned communities in the United States. It was incorporated in 1912, and they really planned out everything from the layout of the roads to what the houses could look like to all kinds of different sort of rules to try and make this little pocket of, of paradise on earth as they saw it. And so I grew up in Shaker Heights in the 90s, which is the era that the book is set in, thinking that that was normal and that that was just sort of how neighborhoods were. This is how the world worked. And it wasn't until I moved away that I realized a lot of the things about Shaker Heights that are unusual, both for good and for less good, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, the book takes place in the 90s, and I personally really appreciated the 90s nostalgia, you know, for better or for worse. But it was like, oh, this is just like the high school years.
And as I mentioned earlier, Shaker Heights is as much a character as a backdrop to the story, you know, the community of rules and order. To me, when I was reading this, it kind of felt like you were saying it's a planned community, and it felt like it believed it could really be the experiment that America is trying to be, you know, living in a multiracial, multicultural society with respect for everyone, equality for everyone, except, well, the other thing about it taking place in the 90s is that there was this notion of color blindness. Maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, in the 90s, when I was growing up there, what I remember about how you expressed your racial awareness was to say, I don't see color, and to pretend that race didn't exist. Shaker Heights has actually always had race at the front of the public conversation since the 1950s. In the 50s, there was a bomb planted at the house of a black lawyer who was living in the area, and the community kind of came together. This was a turning point, and they decided that they were going to really actively act to integrate the community. And since then, race has been a big topic of discussion. There's actually a race relations group at the high school. High school students go and work with fifth and sixth graders, and every fifth and sixth grader gets sort of like a 2 or 3 day racial training seminar, essentially, from these high schoolers. They sit in small groups and they talk about what does prejudice mean? What does discrimination mean? How do we fight peer pressure? How do we fight these things? How do you respond when you have those things? These are all, again, the things that I thought were normal until I went to college and people said, you had a race relations group at your high school.
That's unheard of.
And what often happened was that the fifth and sixth graders would remember their experience and get up to the high school and then join the student group on race relations, which is what it was called. It was one of the kind of cool clubs to be in. And so I was in the student group in race relations. I didn't get in my first year, but I got to go in at my sophomore year.
So it was so popular that it was like a wait list to get in.
Yeah, and it wasn't even wait list. You didn't exactly audition, but you kind of went in and you talked in meetings and they wanted to see how you could facilitate a discussion. They really could pick who they were taking, and they were trying to get a lot of diversity in the group. So the thing about Shaker Heights is that it is really based on these sort of ideals that we can create a perfect community. We can, promote racial equality, all of those things. It's really kind of baked into the community. And of course, the problem is that the real world is very messy. And so even though we're trying to do all those things, the community still has the same blind spots that I think we're struggling with as a country today.
Just the way you're describing this and reading this book and knowing that you were from Shaker Heights, it kind of felt like it was like a very intimate but honest love letter to Shaker Heights. You know, it was because you did have to talk about the realities of why this doesn't work.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you see it as a love letter, because I do too. I mean, I loved growing up there, and I still really love the community, and there's so much about it I think that's really admirable. I think that it's a little bit like writing about a relative where, you know them really well, you want to show all of the good things about them, but you also feel that you need to acknowledge the things that they aren't as good at. I think Shaker Heights actually has a pretty clear-eyed view of itself. They want to be exemplary, and yet they know also that there are ways in which they are still working towards equality, inclusion, on class differences, all of those things. And so I hope that the people who read it do see it as, like you said, as a love letter.
Well, now I'm kind of curious. I know the book has only been out for just a few weeks now. So have you had any community response?
One thing that I can say is that by coincidence, there's been someone from Shaker Heights at pretty much every event that I've done so far. A few of them are people that I know and who've come because they knew me, but many of them are just people who I have no connection with, and they saw Shaker Heights and they come and they say, my mom grew up in Shaker Heights, or I used to live there, or I went to school there, or whatever. And most of them say, this is kind of dead on. And I really appreciate that. That means a lot. And so I hope that the people who are still living there also sort of see it that way.
Sure. I also wanted to ask you what it was like to do the research for this book, because you deep dive into the community and into these characters. What was it like to dig into your hometown, for which you did enjoy growing up there?
It was really fun, actually. Since I set the book in the 90s when I was in high school and I was writing about a bunch of high schoolers, in part, I got to send them to a lot of the places that I loved. And so I had fun nostalgia research, looking through old yearbooks and things like that, and pulling on memories. And then talked to the local history librarian at the Shaker Heights Library, who was incredibly helpful, and she was able to give me newspapers from the time, school newspapers from the exact years that I was looking at, the community news magazine. And I also did a really, really deep dive into the history of the Shakers, who are the religious community that owned the land before Shaker Heights was founded. Shaker Heights was named after them, even though there weren't any Shakers living in Shaker Heights. And I learned way more about the Shakers than any person actually really needs to know. But it was fascinating to see both sort of what the founders of the town and, you know, sort of the early residents of the town envisioned for the city, to compare that to the city that I grew up in, and then also to look back at who had owned the land before them. The Shakers were a utopian community, and to sort of see just how deep that kind of idealism really ran. It's almost sort of leached into the soil.
That's really interesting, and it comes out in these characters. Let's get to the story. The characters include the Richardsons, who are a well-to-do family of six, and they rent out a house to the Warrens, who are Mia, a single mother, and Pearl, her teenage daughter. And these two families are diametrically opposite in this very planned and rural-oriented Shaker Heights city. So there are a lot of issues that come up, and so there's an issue of motherhood and how motherhood is created, how one becomes a mother, and how it's maintained and built and torn and judged and rebuilt. And it was surprising, because I actually tried to avoid reading the blurbs and all of the press material that came with this before reading the story. So then there's this very prominent storyline of what is considered a fit mother, both by just our societal norms as well as in this community. And talk about how that came about, how that plot line came about.
Yeah, so I had developed these two families, the Richardsons, who are sort of the living embodiment of sort of the Shaker Heights ethos, that they're very progressive, they're very well-meaning, they're kind of affluent, and they also have their own blind spots. They're very stable. They've been in the community for several generations. And this mother-daughter pair, Mia, who is sort of the polar opposite. She's a single mother. She's an artist, so she doesn't have sort of a reputable, stable career. They move around a lot, and mm-hmm. they really own almost nothing. They basically just take all of their belongings with them in the car, and that's all they have. And as I sort of put these two families together and kind of thought about the ways that they would get entangled, the ways that they would interact with each other, and the differences that they would find, I realized that what I was writing a lot about was sort of class and about race, and also about motherhood, this issue of sort of mothering. And
it's really entangled in class and race and everything.
Exactly. I mean, all of these things sort of overlap with each other, which makes it a perfect topic for this show. And a storyline of the adoption, where there is an affluent white family from Shaker Heights, friends of the Richardsons, who want to adopt a Chinese-American baby that's been left at a fire station. They've been raising her since she was left, so it's been most of her life so mm-hmm. far. She's almost a year old. And the birth mother comes in and wants her back. And the custody battle that ensues sort of divides the community, and also divides Mia Warren, the single mom from out of town, and Mrs. Richardson, the mother who lives there. That's sort of the flashpoint between them. And the case of the adoption just kind of pulled together all of those threads about race, about class, about sort of what we expect mothers to be like, and the ways that we judge mothers for the things that they do or they don't do, mm-hmm. All of that is something that I keep finding myself drawn to. And so that that adoption case sort of acted as, if you pardon the pun, the sort of spark that kind of lit all of those different fuses.
That lit all of the little fires everywhere.
And we are on fire here at KBOO. And we are on fire here at KBOO right now. My name is Liz. I'm here with Jenna. Say good morning, Jenna.
Good morning.
And we're on fire to hear from you. Pick up mm-hmm. the phone right now, 877-500-5266, or go online to kboo.fm. We are in the middle of our holiday membership drive, and I know yesterday officially was Giving Tuesday, but we're going to call this Giving Wednesday too, because, it's Wednesday.
Yeah.
And not only are we asking you to give to us, but we have stuff that we'd love to give to you. One of those things that we can give to you when you become a member right now is to enter you in a drawing for four pairs of VIP tickets to Portland Center Stage at the Armory. Another thing that we can give to you, and this is just for one lucky caller because we've only got one copy left, is a copy of Celeste Ng's book, Little Fires Everywhere. One copy can be yours for a $60 a year membership. That's just $5 a month. Mm-hmm. Jenna, is that not amazing?
I think that is amazing because, I mean, listen to the just the quality of the interviews that we have here on KBOO, right? It's like, here's this award-winning author with this amazing book, and you can get it for, you know, just coming in at $5 a month. And yeah, you get the book and, you know, $5 a month. And you also get to become a member of KBOO, and you're investing in your community. You're investing in these conversations that are happening. So to become a member, 877-500-5266. You can also go online to kboo.fm. We have a donate button there, and you can help us meet our goal for the hour. We have a goal of 360, but our listeners have been so amazing that they're actually helping us really make that goal very quickly.
But we're not there yet.
But we're not there yet, right. We still need just a few of you more to give us a call. So one more time, here's how you call, 877-500-5266.
And we'd like to thank William in Portland for renewing his membership. Let's hear it from William. And if you'd like to hear more cowbell, we're all into the cowbell
more
here.
Cowbell.
More cowbell. We'll ring that cowbell every time we hear from a new or renewing member. You can also, you know, since this is a giving kind of season and people are thinking of gifts, you can give a membership as a gift.
Oh,
what
yeah.
a cool idea.
Yeah.
What an amazing idea. And, you know, now's the time to do that. 877-500-5266. You know, I want to turn the tables on you just a little bit. We often, during these membership drives, we come on the air and we talk about how much we need you. And that's very true. We do need you. You're our community support. You're our community in the community radio segment of who we are. But you know what? You need us, too. You know why? Because mm-hmm. we bring you stuff nobody else does. I mean, think about just this program this morning. You're hearing two different stories of adoption. And adoption is always a complicated issue, even when it's the most straightforward kind of adoption, you know, same race, same class, that kind of thing. These stories are much more nuanced, much more complex, the kind of stories that mainstream media is not going to be able to bring you in their tiny little sound bites. But we are going in depth, and we know that you appreciate that kind of in-depth reporting and interviewing because you're listening to us right now. So we know that we need you, but we also just want to point out that you need us too, because nobody else is doing this here in Portland. And we know that you appreciate it because you're listening. So take that next step. Pick up the phone right now, 877-500-5266, or go online to kboo.fm. Don't forget, you can pick up a copy of Celeste's book,
Little Fires Everywhere,
for just $60 membership. Now's the time. There's only one copy. Don't wait.
Now help us meet that goal. We're so close.
Carpe bookum. Let's get back to the interview.
One of the major issues that we unfortunately still talk about is who deserves to be a mother. That is to say, who deserves to have a child, to keep a child. And as a mother, you are not allowed to make one mistake. You are not allowed to have any sort of dip in what is expected of you. I mean, more than I think other parents and relatives and caretakers and guardians.
I think it's much more, we're much tougher on mothers.
Mothers are tougher on mothers.
And mothers are tougher on mothers, exactly. There's this sort of standard, I think, that the mothers have to basically be perfect and do everything, and yet also at the same time are criticized by everyone, including themselves, about every aspect of motherhood. You know, did you have your children too early? Did you have your children too late? Maybe mm-hmm. you had too many children. Maybe you've been trying too long and it's because you're working too hard and you haven't put enough priority on that. If you decide to adopt, then you're not having your own biological children. Mm-hmm. You know, if you decide that you're going to do in vitro fertilization, why are you doing such an invasive thing when there are children that need homes? You basically have lost from the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, I think in
your
the
body
way
is
that,
not yours.
And I think then even after you have the child, you know, I think mothers more than anybody are screwed. scrutinized for every decision they make, whether they decide to work, whether they decide to go back, how long they decide to take off, whether they how they decide to feed their children. You know, just it's such a, it's, this area is just so rife with judgment. And that's one of the questions of the book, which is sort of what happens to a mother of any kind, adoptive, biological, chosen mother, when they can't give you all of the things that you need. There's a question raised in the adoption storyline about, you know, who's a fit mother and who gets to, you know, who gets to make a mistake? You know, if you've made a mistake, are you done? Are there no do-overs, as a different radio interviewer asked me? And the problem is that those standards are usually applied really unevenly, and this is where mm-hmm. we get into class and we get into race.
Right.
That the actions of mothers who are less privileged we weigh those really heavily. You know, we're kind of a one strike and you're out often. And it's hard not to think about what's lost if we're applying that kind of standard to motherhood.
Right. Like you were saying, this is an immigrant mother.
Yes.
Who ends up leaving her child because she has really hit rock bottom for a number of reasons that I think many of us would have. And a lot of it just had to do with access to money and resources.
Exactly. That she's a single mom, mm-hmm. And she's working a blue collar job as a waitress. She's a new immigrant, and so she kind of doesn't know about what support systems there are. And, you know, the support systems that are there are not necessarily adequate either. And
she couldn't afford the very basics, like
exactly.
diapers and formula for
exactly.
a child.
And so she's criticized for not providing those things. And it's true, you know, those are things that you do need. But at the same time, the question is really, if she's working this kind of job and that's all that they're paying her and there's no support network for her, is it fair to punish her? Is there a better
right.
way than by giving her child to another family? It's really complicated, and one of the things I wanted to do in the novel really was to just kind of peel back how complicated it is, because I don't think there are easy answers.
No, and that brings me to my next point, which is that this book has really extreme characters. I mean, just within the Richardsons and the Warrens, who are the two main families, but also other characters who come in. Everybody is sort of on extremes. But because you do this deep dive into the characters, we see their complexity and we see their humanity and their flaws, and we see the full history of how everyone got to where they are. This must have been a process for you. Talk about it.
It was a process. I mean, one of the things that was really important to me was that there not be a villain in the book. And the flip side, of course, that there not be a clear hero. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anybody here who doesn't have a little bit of dirt on their hands. And there's also nobody in here who's just sort of the mustache twirler and just this force of malevolence. I have a 7-year-old son at home, and I'm learning that at his age, they're really interested in this idea of who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. And one of the things that we talk about is that bad guys often don't think that they're bad guys. Bad guys often think that they're doing the right thing. They think they're acting for good.
They think they're the heroes.
Exactly. And that's a really complicated idea for a kid to get his head around. It's a complicated idea for adults to get their head around, too. But I wanted each of the characters to be complex enough that you would at least understand why they were doing the things they were doing. Even if you didn't agree, even if you didn't like them, even if you think that you would never do that, it was really important for me, for example, to make sure that people saw the adoptive parents also as sympathetic figures who do have a real claim on this baby. You know, they've been taking care of her since she was about a month old. They're the ones who have been doing the day-to-day mm-hmm. work of mothering, right? At the same time, also to sort of look at the biological mother's ties beyond just saying, well, she's biologically hers, sort of what led her up to giving up her baby. And the same was true for all of those characters. I belong to a writer's group in Boston, and when I showed them early pages of the novel, they would really helpfully call me on it and say, I feel like the narrative is pushing us to be really sympathetic to this character over this character. And that was a time where I would have to say, okay, I have to go back and dig a little bit deeper, make it a little bit more complicated so that we can just see that all of these characters are making difficult choices and doing the best that they can.
We do see that pretty equally dealt out with everybody. We talked a little bit about this with the custody battle in the story. I mean, I obviously have to bring up the issue of birthright cultural heritage. Mm-hmm. it's what turns this whole element of Shaker Heights, believing that they are so equal and so colorblind, it turns it on its head. You know, you and I come from immigrant parents. How do you feel about that notion in contemporary times as compared to in the 90s?
It's complicated. I mean, like you said, you know, I'm the child of immigrants. My parents came from Hong Kong, and there's already enough sort of space between me and my, you know, quote unquote, like birth culture. Mm-hmm. I don't speak Cantonese, which is my family's dialect. I'm pretty familiar with the food, but I don't, you know, I don't have a lot of other cultural ties. I don't know a lot of the sort of rituals and traditions and all of those things. And with a young child, I'm thinking a lot about what I can pass on to him and in what ways this kind of heritage can seem meaningful to him. Mm-hmm. I don't have the answers to that yet, but I do know that I want it to be a part of his life. You know, I want it to be something that he at least has access to if he chooses to do that. And I think in the 90s, you know, that was really a time where we talked a lot about assimilation. And there was sort of this idea that your culture was sort of like it was like a piece of clothing that you could kind of take off. And then if you wanted to, maybe you could put it back on later. But the idea that, you know, what was really important first and foremost was sort of you fitting into the place that you were in. That was how I remember the discussion going at the
time.
Me
too.
And that's an issue that we're thinking about in a slightly more complicated way now. We're just saying, what might be lost if you don't have that? And I think the pendulum maybe has swung back a little way. I feel like there's an interest now in a lot of people about sort of reclaiming different parts of their culture. And thinking about the genetic testing that is really popular now. It's really cheap, but it's also really, people are really interested to sort of find out, where did I come from biologically? And that tells them something about themselves, or it changes how they see themselves. And, you know, we have that feeling that, you know, the roots that you came from and your biology and your, you know, your actual DNA has some bearing on who you are, right? It's not all just nurture. There is nature in there. And so I don't know really where the discussion is headed from here, but at the time, I feel like there was so much emphasis that was placed on, you know, kind of assimilation, like I said, about, you know, sort of this is all about nurture. This is all about, you know, what's best for the child. And now we're realizing that there's always going to be a trade-off, that you're going to lose something. As the lawyer says, you know, he's asking, you know, do you have any books that feature Asian characters? Do you have any dolls that look anything like this child? Are they all blonde and blue-eyed? You know, do you have any connection to Chinese culture that you'll be able to give her, you know, as she gets older, that will, you know, allow her access to that part of the identity? And those are hard questions.
They are. And, you know, it has me thinking, we both have children and we both value our birthright cultures. For me, I feel sometimes like it's this burden. I represent my entire community. Are you kidding me? I cannot represent complex
billion people. Yeah.
But it, because of the communities that we're in, we end up being the 1 billion representation.
That's sort of
it's
it. I mean,
a burden.
You end up being sort of the touchstone, you know, like it or not, and for better or for worse. And I feel like maybe the best that we can do is hope to be sort of like a window or a door through which that culture can be accessed, because it's going to be different things to everybody. I mean, I said both of my parents came from Hong Kong, which is true, but my dad was born in mainland China in a small rural village, and my mom was born and raised in Hong Kong, and my father came over to Hong Kong a little bit later when he was an adolescent. And to an outsider, you know, to, I think, a non-Chinese person, you go, oh, you're both Cantonese speakers. You're both, you know, from the same region. You both grew up in Hong Kong.
Easy.
Easy.
Right.
The way that they look at the world is incredibly different.
Yeah.
You know, Hong Kong being a British colony, my mom has a certain amount of British influence in her and in her perspective. And the novel that I wrote took place in Cleveland. And there's a huge divide between the west side of Cleveland and the east side of Cleveland. Nobody crosses over from one side to another. And you're like, this is one city in Ohio, and
right.
We're just talking about, it's not even divided by, you know, like a chasm. It's,
yeah.
It's, you know, you think about that, that's kind of a human thing, that we're going to always be sort of subdividing ourselves into smaller categories. So to go back to your question, the idea that, you know, one person can represent a culture, as if that culture is a monolithic thing, is
right.
Is problematic. But I think that I think that we are starting to be more aware of just the ways in which you can say, like, that is a world that you can enter, right? There are lots of things in it, you know, that's a building with many rooms. And I know about one of them, but you should be able to go to that room.
Right.
That question of representation, I feel like, has become more at the front of our conversation now.
Celeste Ng, thank you so much for joining me this time in person on Intersections Radio.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That was my guest, Celeste Ng. The book is Little Fires Everywhere, and it's out now where books are sold. To listen to the podcast of this interview, check out intersectionsradio.wordpress.com. Visit the same website for previous episodes of this podcast, and join the Facebook community at facebook.com/intersectionsradio. You're listening to Intersections Radio. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.
That interview was such good stuff.
Totally.
Well, by the way, if you are wondering, like, who are those people talking? I am Jenna. I'm joined here this morning with Liz, and you are listening to the KBOO Holiday Membership Drive, our quick one-week drive here. Give us a call, 877-500-5266 to become a member today, because your support is what makes KBOO happen. And you know what? If you become a member today or renew, you will be entered into our daily drawing. And today's drawing is for four pairs of VIP tickets to Portland Center Stage at the Armory. So again, it's 877-500-5266. Help us make that goal for this hour, which we have a $360 goal. And so, you know, give us a call.
That's right. And if you're not able to give us a call, you can go online and reach us that way. You'll also be entered into the drawing if you go to kboo.fm, click on the donate button, and become a member, just like Howard in Portland.
Ooh, yeah,
for
Howard.
Renewing his membership. Thank you so much. And Laura in Milwaukee also for renewing. We love ringing that cowbell. We would love to ring it for you, but you need to call us right now. 877-500-5266 or go online kboo.fm. Remember, you can pick up four pairs of VIP tickets by being entered into the drawing, but you got to become a member or contact us in some way. Renew your membership, gift your membership, increase your membership. Hey, there's an idea. But now's the time to do it. 877-500-5266. Go online kboo.fm. We want to thank everybody who called in this hour and became a member, renewed their membership, gifted a membership, increased their membership. We can't wait to thank you too. But you gotta call us first.
Okay, let's do it fun one more time.
877-500-5266 or go online kboo.fm. Thanks so much.
KBOO would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who have donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Bird and Bear, located 2801 Southeast Holgate Boulevard in Portland, and serving fresh comfort food in a comfortable setting. Lunch was provided by Little River Cafe, located 315 Southwest Montgomery Street in Portland. Sandwiches, hamburgers, and salads are made with locally sourced ingredients at this chic, artsy cafe. Dinner was provided by Fire on the Mountain, brewery and catering, with three locations in Portland. Go to portlandwings.com. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266.